we're there to a carpenter, because every single morning my father would get up early, he'd shave himself, and a very grumpy little boy would hear a totally discordant version of England Arrives. But I don't hold it against David Carpenter in the slightest. I've begun to realise that here we've got someone who's an absolute giant of British socialism. He's somebody who pushed the boundaries well beyond the existing thought of his time, whether you're talking in terms of ecology, sexuality, whatever. He was there well before the others. The other thing about him is that very clearly he played an important role in the movement. And for me, the nicest little anecdote about him was when he used to go to periodically to a pub in Clyde, and he'd play the piano there for the Clarion cyclists when they came back after their missionary work in the Derbyshire villages, spreading the word of socialism. But quite frankly, you need more than these sort of little fragments from me, and we're lucky because having Sally and Rowan, we have people who do really know about Edward Carpenter. And so I'm just going to hand over to them.
Lovely anecdotes, though.
We're going to get fragments this afternoon, partly because we are fragmentary ourselves. And as you'll hear, Sally and I, although we're both Carpenter enthusiasts, we come at it in different ways. And there are differences between us which should make the afternoon more interesting. Sally, I should say, is the youngest person in the room.
No, possibly. I'm not.
And I'm probably the oldest, so we're doing this thread there. We're going to gallop through Edward Carpenter's life to start with. We're going to tell you about our connections with Carpenter. We're going to show you some pictures related to it. And then we're going to break, and then we're going to have a discussion, and everybody's going to chip in. That's what.
But also his connections with here, Chesterfield and Millthorpe, North Yorkshire as well, as we go along. we're just going to have a quick gallop first. Now, as Ronnie says, you know, explore our connections, both our connections and our crossovers with Carpenter and becoming enthusiasts, and along the way, perhaps in the discussion, finding out about your connections as well, and what your stories might be, a little bit of yours, and how, you know, we often think, what would Edward Carpenter say about that? So it'd be really interesting to hear from you. So, Edward Carpenter, 1844 to 1929, upper middle class background, gay, Cambridge graduate, ex-curate, Walt Whitman enthusiast, political writer, poet, mystic, lecturer, socialist, anarchist, feminist, political activist, utopian, lover of working class men, friend to many, kind, slightly lax vegetarian and teetotaler, sexologist, friend of William Morris, Ian Forster, Olive Schreiner, Bernard Shaw, Havelock Ellis, many more, may have met D.H. Lawrence, but we're not sure, no, but neither is anybody else, writer to Gandhi, dress reformer, inventor of the radical sandal, nudist, sunbather, simple lifer, environmentalist, talker to chickens, market gardener, meditator, parish councillor, new lifer, pianist, composer, traveller, including across classes, and lover of the East. Also, astronomer and mathematician, pacifist, rambler.
Born in 1844, upper class gay man, Cambridge educated, out ordained as a curate in the Church of England, gave that up, read and met the poet Walt Whitman in America, which he described, I think, as the most transforming influence on his life. It was very, very important. He was a poet, so he said all this stuff. But Whitman was his turning point, I think.
Sort of prophet, and he even sort of modelled himself on him in how he looked. I think that hat is very Whitman-ish. And Whitman talked to him, you know, when Carpenter met Whitman in America, he was very impressed by Whitman's connections with working people and decided to give up his clerkship and come up north to be amongst people who were not of his own class. Gave away his dress suit and his top hat. He came up to teach in the university extension movement, a bit like the sort of WEA of his day. But starts to write this rather amazing long sequence of poems in a book called Towards Democracy, which are strange to read now. Not somebody described them as being like Whitman with water. He's obviously modelled them on Whitman. They're not terribly good. There are bits that are good.
There are interesting things about Towards Democracy. This is an edition I bought somewhere online from 1921 from Oundle School. And it's a really posh version with the Oundle School logo on the front in rice paper. It was a very popular book. It's on his right. It's very hard to read now, but unless you go out in the open air and say it to each other. And it's sometimes we did. And it sometimes means something again, but it's tricky. But it was immensely popular. People took it to the First World War and died in the trenches with copies of Towards Democracy in it. Anyway, this is one of the many editions that we've got. I noticed the bookstore, among many other things, has got Towards Democracy in its collections. Whitman with water, yeah.
And it's got bits of Derbyshire landscape in it, bits of Sheffield.
Wonderful
as
account
well.
Of Sheffield.
Wonderful account of Sheffield and how ghastly it is in the middle and how wonderful it is towards the edges once you start to walk out, because of course in those days it's very difficult to imagine it now.
He wrote in the open air, crucially, he describes his own way of working, which is he puts some sheds up in various places and sits out all year round writing in the open air, but he did only write that in the open air, and you might be able to feel that. He bought some land out at Millthorpe, which is where he lived from 1880s. He bought some land and built a house of his own. Anyone been out there to Millthorpe?
Yes.
You have. It's a very interesting house because you can't see how you get in it. Have you been around the back as well? It hasn't got a front door. It's just a kind of wall with some
windows
back to front, yeah.
Very plain. People criticised it for being rather plain. It's got no architectural sort of...
You had the piano in the kitchen, interestingly. And in the garden, which they ran as a sort of market garden, you also had a river going through where they used to strip off and swim naked.
And his writing hut, of
And
course.
His writing hut where he wrote
Chickens.
It towards him.
I've just realised that I've got a rather nice picture of him here. I think pre-sandal, pre-Millthorpe days. He's a young man here. Same pose though, isn't it? This is a lovely painting by Duncan Grant, the famous artist from the Bloomsbury Group. There he is looking rather smart. But when he moves to Sheffield, well, actually he moves out to Bradway, which in those days was in Derbyshire. It's all surrounded now, the house that he moved to, by the Low Edges council estate, but in those days was all fields. And he moves to live with a scythe maker, Albert Ferninghoff, and his family, who live on a farm. Charles Fox is the farmer, he's a sort of free-thinking farmer, and I think Carpenter's met him and Ferninghoff at one of his classes. And he goes out, amazingly, an upper middle class man, to live with this family out at Bradway, briefly at Totley as well, but moves back to Bradway to live with Albert Ferninghoff. And Albert Ferninghoff and his family do move out with Carpenter to live at Millthorpe. Here's a nice postcard of it you can see, you know, that it is quite a plain house there, and that's the back of it. Well, but it's sort of built back to front, so although it's the back of it, it's the more interesting side. Who have we got? Yes, he moves out to Milthorpe and with Fernie Huff runs it as a sort of market garden. And they even sell potatoes at Chesterfield Market. Again, you know, he was into sort of trying manual work, although I'm sure he left most of it to Albert. He's still to and fro to Sheffield, and in sort of early 80s, hooks up with William Morris and Hindman, joins, well, he doesn't actually join either the SDF or the all the Socialist League, he sort of always hedges his bets a little bit. But in 1885, starts the Sheffield Socialist Society. And this is George Hukin, who also joined, who was a Sheffield razor grinder, and Carpenter falls in love. Unfortunately, Hukin is getting married, where they do have a relationship, and Carpenter sinks into a deep, deep depression about this. But this man, if you go to Sheffield Archives, there's loads of letters from Hukin to Carpenter, which for me, reading them, are great, because it isn't often that you can find in archives direct stuff about the daily lives of working people. And these letters are amazing, both for his relationship with Carpenter, or his work, but also his work in the Socialist Society. He's a bit of a quiet, shy, but diplomatic man.
I think if you listen very carefully throughout what happens this afternoon, you will realise that Sally is very much in love with George Hukin. One of the curiosities of Carpenter's love life is that he fell in love with Georges one after the other.
Yes.
And when you begin to research him, you get the Adamses mixed up with the Merrills, gets mixed up with Hukin. But Sally has increasingly, over recent years, become more and more fond of George Hukin, who was a very small man compared with me, certainly. He was very small. But you listen out for how many mentions you get. While Carpenter was on Scotland Street running the Socialist Cafe there,
the Commonwealth Cafe,
and being involved, he wrote the famous Chant of Labour, with his collection of Socialist songs. But there's a copy of it over there, which is wonderful. He also wrote England Arise. Does anybody know that? Because we're going to learn. Good, because we're going to learn that bit at the end of the afternoon. Sally's brought her recording. We're going to sing "England Arise." It's very interesting because it occurs if you went to a certain kind of school or church as a younger person yourself. It occurs in Songs of Praise, the hymn book that Vaughan Williams among others put together, and you can see why Vaughan Williams would be an enthusiast for it. He also wrote a better tune for it than Carpenter did. But "England Arise" is Carpenter's probably most famous achievement. It was still being sung in schools, it was still being sung at rallies until living memory.
Woodcraft folk
were still doing it at camps in my children's time. It's got 15 verses at worst. We've done the 15 verses at
We're
a
not
beautiful.
Do that.
But we will sing "England Arise" before the end of the time. And it's interesting, Sally's right, that in the difficulties of their love lives, he was writing this hopeful song about revolution while his life fell apart, really.
When he moves out to Milthorpe, it's amazing, really, because it becomes a sort of hub for all sorts of people. Carpenter, I think, above anything, he's really a bit forgotten today, but I think he was this great networker and a kind man, charismatic man, a bit of a guru figure at times, and people flocked there. And it became a sort of crossover point for across classes. You know, he talks about how ploughboys mixed with the young sprigs of aristocracy. You know, there's all sorts of people that go out there and are inspired by what he's doing. What have we got here? Oh, this is him and Hukin in the garden at Milthorpe. What I haven't got here is George Merrill, the lover that he had for the rest of his life, and is actually buried with him on the other side. And this, well, unfortunately I haven't got the original. I keep meaning to ask the archives in Sheffield, for a print. So, you know, they put this, don't they, on the internet when you download it, so that you don't do what I've just done. But this is, this, I look at this picture and I go, who are you? Because these are the Sheffield Socialists in the, I think, the 1880s. Here is Carpenter with a child. I think this is George Adams, who was another, yet another George, who also moved out to Millthorpe and was the sandal maker, actually. And a working class background, wanted to be an artist, and indeed was an artist, and later moved to Letchworth Garden City and continued to make sandals there. This is Hukin. This woman, look, although his wife was about 10 years older than him, she still looks a little old to me as well, but they look a bit fond of each other, don't they? I think this might be Raymond Unwin. I'm not sure. Raymond Unwin, who was at Staveley, and later became one of the architects of the Garden City movement. Very important man. But who the other people are, I don't know. I like to think this is Joseph Sharp, ex-chartist, harpist, died at Homesfield, joins Sheffield Socialist. And one of these women is Mrs. Malloy, who was very gobby. I've been finding out more about her. She was always falling out with people. But, you know, you don't tend to hear much about the women of the early socialist movement, but she was one. So, who else have we got? Yeah, George Adams, I discovered, after he split up with Carpenter, because they did fall out quite badly, moved to Fanshawgate Hall, which is up on Fanshawgate Lane near Homesfield. And it's all rather posh now. He might have been to the open gardens there. But at the turn of the century, it was quite a sort of dishevelled farm. And I discovered on the census, much to the amazement of the people who live there now, that George and Adams had lived there making sandals. Here's Raymond Unwin. Responsible for some of the buildings at New Earswick in York. Very important to town planning and the whole history of working class architecture. So we're just whizzing through some places. This is another, the home of another of the Sheffield Socialists, John Furness, who, this isn't him, this is prior to him moving in, I think. I found this on the internet. But it's Moorhay Farm near Wigley, near Linacre Reservoirs. And John Furness was a staunch lay preacher, Christian socialist, temperance, as a lot of them were, and great friend of Carpenter's, working class man, been involved in quarrying and farming. And here, he set up in 1886 a communal farm and quarry. And Charles Ashby, the arts and craftsman, visited there with Carpenter. Carpenter took him on a bit of a tour. He took him to the steelworks in Sheffield, and he took him here. And while Carpenter helped with the hay, Furness showed Ashby round, and Ashby says they were like early Christians. And he was very impressed with what was going on there. Another of the early socialists was George Pearson, great friend of John Furness's. They worked a lot together, and Pearson took on this place, St George's Farm, which had been started, financed by Ruskin as a communal farm. It all went a bit wrong, but Pearson ended up living there, and indeed Pearson's grandson, Howard, still runs a market garden nearby at Dronfield Woodhouse. So I'm just whizzing through them. That's the farm today. And last year, I did a walking performance where we started there. And here's the Pearson family in the early 20th century, about 1910. And the very last letter that I think Carpenter ever wrote was to George, saying, "Dear George, blah, 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 I'm a rare old crock now." Another great friend, Bert Ward, the the arch king of the Ramblers, trespasser, campaigner for access, lived at Moorwood's Lane, just outside Sheffield into Derbyshire, and every year produced these wonderful little books, which I expect a lot of you have seen, which are a bit like the TARDIS I always describe, because they've got, you know, they're very small on the outside, but very big on the inside, with all sorts of information in, written by Ward, that's even useful now. And every year, Bert helped to organise a memorial service for Carpenter after he died.
So they did this opening show that she's talking about last year, this walking play, round Topley, going round the various scenes. Ruskin did appear in it, but Carpenter appeared in it, played by Raf Singer, who was my friend from Radio Sheffield, who, as you'll guess from, if you've never met him from his name, is of Indian descent. So Carpenter was played by this very dignified Indian in the play, and Bert Ward is played by Norman Mills, you may have seen in your theatres around here, who was a big burly man, looks a bit like that. And they did a scene out in the rain during the course of the play that was magical, and Sally played somebody's wife. She was pretty good as well. There are just two things we ought to add before we move into the next instalment, I think. I think if that's the end of the slide.
Yeah, well, yeah.
There was a moment of history that Carpenter was involved in, quite a turning point, I think, in English Labour history. After Bloody Sunday, in which a demonstration was broken up by the police, and Carpenter and Bernard Shaw were both there. Bernard Shaw was a significant figure in Carpenter's life, though they were in some ways very different. He used to come out to Millthorpe, so Bernard Shaw tramped around with sandals on, with his feet bleeding at one stage, saying all that. But Carpenter and Shaw were at the big Bloody Sunday demonstration that was broken up by the police. And Carpenter gave evidence in court about it afterwards, and he was asked by the magistrate or whatever, did you see any violence? And his reply was, not on the part of the people, sir. That's the side he was on. And the other thing I would mention is E.M. Forster. We may have mentioned Forster already, but E.M. Forster is part of this big story that you'll hear this afternoon.
And actually, you know, a Carpenter as a supporter and counsellor to men who were struggling with their sexuality, E.M. Forster was one of those. And Forster says something like, he came to me and helped me in my loneliness.
Forster writes a book very much like Lady Chatterley's Lover, but about a love affair between men. The suspicion is that the man in the story is George Merrill, Carpenter's friend. The suspicion among Laurentians is that D.H. Lawrence might have based his love affair on the same story, the gamekeeper and the woman in Lady Chatterley. There's a sort of set of thoughts about that, which are explored in a book called D.H. Lawrence and Edward Carpenter a few years ago. But E.M. Forster describes in a wonderful account at the beginning of the published edition of Maurice, the book that he wrote about his own homosexual story, in which he describes George Merrill. And that's the George I like, if there's a dispute between us. And that's the George I am still writing about now. George Merrill followed Forster into a room, I think, somewhere, and touched his bottom. And Forster described, do you remember how he's described?
It's kind of a conception.
He touched him and he feels this extraordinary feeling throughout his whole body. And he is transformed.
He says his book
by
is
Merrill
conceived.
Yeah, his book's conceived there. And he's goosed by George Merrill, which is why
But do you want to describe what we're going to do now?
We're going to try and tell the same story, but through ourselves. Kind of a quick gallop through how we came across Carpenter and what he's sort of met at different stages in our lives. Because in a strange way, he's really important to us, isn't he? My mother met, you see, not only does my son also not like me singing England Arise first thing in the morning, but my mother met Edward Carpenter in what must have been about 1920 when he was living out at Millthorpe. My granddad, Leon Chandler, was a very keen socialist himself. I've got his socialist songbook somewhere, which includes the Carpenter songs. And Grandad Chandler went out, I think possibly with Nanny Chandler, out to Millthorpe and met Carpenter was with my mum. I didn't know anything about Edward Carpenter, so we were passing by in a car sometime when I was about 17, and we saw a little notice outside the house in Millthorpe that said Carpenter House. My older brother Geth said it was George Carpentier, the boxer. But I later found out it was Edward Carpenter the Socialist. When I went to university, I wrote a paper for my history lot in the college about Edward Carpenter and spent 6 weeks in the archive in Sheffield reading all about Edward Carpenter and copying it down longhand. That's the only real research I've ever done. So almost everything I now say about Carpenter is what I am half remembering from ever such a long time ago, which is why the dates don't matter. But the research mattered. The research mattered enormously to me because I felt I was discovering as a history student a whole world in all these different ways Sally refers to, because it takes in all kinds of classes of people. And the evidence, Carpenter kept his whole life. His own letters are there and the replies are there. He's got his own sermons from when he was at Cambridge as a very young vicar. He's got his whole life. There's a lock of his mother's hair in there. There is sandals that he wore. There's a Saxon smock that he made to walk around the garden like a dress. It's all in the archives in Sheffield, next to Radio Sheffield, down by the railway station. And anyone can look at it. A complete life of a man that was mostly, at least half of it, lived around here. So I got into Carpenter as a student, and I went on being interested in Carpenter, well, as you can see, for the rest of my life.
Meanwhile, that was the sort of 1950s, wasn't it, when you were
I'm
at
afraid
university?
It was.
I'm about 12 years younger, so I was at primary school singing from Songs of Praise, but I never noticed England Arise, I'm ashamed to say.
I think it's hymn number 314, but I'm not sure that isn't the classroom number of one of the schools I taught at. But it's certainly in there. England Arise is in there, with both tunes.
But no mention of God.
No, there's no mention of God. That's absolutely right. And although it's a revolutionary song, it's a bit peaceful, but it's got some harshness in it. Where have we got to? Is it still me? Sally's not been born yet, so we're still in somewhere in the 1960s. In the late 1960s, I was a teacher down in London, and I wrote a novel about a comprehensive school in which the school students were revolting. 1968, which one or two of you might remember, was a time of revolt through the world. And students in universities, and then in schools, started disobeying their teachers and not going in and leaving the classroom. And they did, and I was in London when that was going on. I was never quite sure which side I was on in it. But I wrote a novel about it called The Ted Carp Tradition, because the school in the novel was called the Edward Carpenter School. And the kids in the revolt in the school found some of Edward Carpenter's books in the library and read them to each other. So I used Carpenter in my own writing, and that novel was published. The consequence of that novel being published was that I got some work at the New Crucible Theatre in Sheffield. Just started, and there was a little theatre company associated with it called Vanguard that were putting on little plays down Scotland Street. Scotland Street, if you remember, was where Edward Carpenter ran the Socialist Cafe, by absolute coincidence. We rehearsed the play that I'd written called Edward Carpenter Lives, and it then moved straight away into the Crucible Studio in Sheffield. It was the first new play at the Crucible. It was the first play I'd ever written. And it was done in the Crucible Studio, and it finished with a shout at the end of itself, Edward Carpenter Lives, and somebody in the audience stood up and agreed. It was the sort of play about asking what a Sheffield man, obviously me, would think about Edward Carpenter now. And it was a slightly jokey version about Carpenter, in which it was a play within a play, with, you know, it was very 1960s, 70s stuff. I did a second play that nobody came to see, which is much better, at the Crucible, and I rewrote that play down in Coventry as well. So I did three plays on the trot about Edward Carpenter, and I got back into him that way. I occasionally did things on the telly and the radio. I became known as the person in Sheffield you might go to if you wanted to talk about Carpenter, and they came and talked to me, and I did those bits and pieces. And then I went on with my life. Meanwhile, Sally was being born.
No, I was born in 1953. But by the early 70s, I was going to university, getting into feminism, getting into being a vegetarian, wearing Indian sandals and cheesecloth smocks, if you remember those.
Mm-hmm.
Went to university, became interested in gay politics as well, through friends. I put up a theatre group in my room while I was away called Gay Sweatshop. One of whose members was Noel Gregg, who was later to write another play like Roney called Dear Love of Comrades about Edward Carpenter. The interesting thing when I left university and went to live in London for a while was that I went to an evening class about social and labour history, late 19th century, and the teacher was Sheila Robotham, who, of course, much later became Carpenter's biographer. Sheila opened my eyes to the North and what was going on up here. You know, it was a people's history that I hadn't heard before, and it's where I first learned about Carpenter.
While Sheila Robotham was down in East London, she had a baby, and I was working at the Theatre Royal Stratford East, and I'd got a play on there. I'd met Sheila in Sheffield very briefly, but I got some phone number or something of the kind, and I thought she might be interested in coming to see a play at the Theatre Royal Stratford East. It was at John Littlewood's Theatre, what a lovely war theatre, a kind of lefty place, and she'd have loved it. So I got her a free ticket, thanks to the woman around the theatre then, who came to run the Crucible in the end. I got her a free ticket, and she brought her small baby along, and between us we looked after her baby while she saw my play. So possibly at the same time Sally was having lectures from her, I'd given her a free ticket at the Theatre Royal Stratford.
We also used to have, I think it was the Hackney and Islington choir come and sing songs, and I noticed on your website that you had the Nottingham Clarion Choir last time. So, you know, it's a nice, that mix, and of course Carpenter was into all of that as well. I leave London and go and live collectively and communally myself, 20 miles from Sheffield, high up on the moors.
I've come back from London, I'm living in Sheffield by this time with my firstborn child, who has to listen to me singing England Arise in the Morning.
Yeah, so meanwhile I'm trying to live the collective life, it's all quite difficult, trying to grow your own food like Carpenter did. And I think, you know, it's not a coincidence that Sheila is writing about him at that time. In fact, she talks about this, that, you know, there are those connections between all the things that we were into in the 1970s and this model of what Carpenter was doing, a sort of broader socialism, which took in how you lived your life and all these strange things that got rather disparaged by George Orwell, who called, what did he call?
Sandal Wearer's Law,
Creeping
Jesus,
and things like that.
The other one that's happening, of course, up here, is that while in the 80s, Thatcher, Tory governments and the rest of it, there is the Socialist Republic of South Yorkshire, not of North Derbyshire, incidentally, but of South Yorkshire. And there was this continuing sense that, in Sheffield anyway, something was going to go on that would kind of be in opposition to what was happening with Mrs. Thatcher. And among other things, there's a bit of that one there, you did have that. The Socialist Republic was approached by a man from the Gay Men's Press to ask if the Sheffield Council could send somebody down to Guildford. Edward Carpenter died in Guildford, and he'd been there for the last several years of his life, and the local Labour people down there wanted to have some celebration at Carpenter's grave, which, as Sally said, is where the two of them, him and George, were buried. And they wanted somebody to go down from Sheffield, and they'd heard that 20 years before I'd written a play, would I like to go down to Guildford if they paid my train fare? And I went down to Guildford, so one of the most extraordinary events of my life, really. I was going to read it, but I'll remind myself as I do. It was a celebration of Edward Carpenter by the Gay Men's Press, who produced another lovely edition of some early Carpenter stuff. And they'd invited all kinds of people down there to stand at the graveside. Sheila Robotham was down there, of course, as she'd written about him already. So was the Red Vicar of Darnall, as he was called, from Sheffield, who was a communist vicar in the 1930s, 40s, 50s. And he was there with his son, Jake, who was a trade union leader. I was there. The gay bloke who'd done the documentation of the book was there. The local Labour people from all over Surrey were there, insofar as there were any. And we all stood round the graveside, and that we heard lots of speeches. And then right at the end, the suggestion was we should sing England Arise. And it was one of those moments where everyone doesn't quite look at anybody else. And nobody does it, not the great Sheila Robotham, the biographer, not the bloke from the Gay Men's Press, not the Reverend Eccleston and his son, not Ronnie Robinson. And we shuffled away from the graveside without singing England Arise. And I sort of vowed on that occasion that if we ever did any functions like it ever again, we would sing England Arise at the end of the event.
We're going to.
We are.
But we've not ended yet, have we?
We nearly have. There's all sorts of things happen after that. I become involved in a lot of musical stuff in Sheffield and the street band, and we go on CND demonstrations, and it's the miners' strike. and all of that, all of which I'm sure Carpenter, we hope, would have loved.
In the late 80s, I wrote a novel called Urbino, which was about a trip to the seaside in 1914 by some workers just before the outbreak of the First World War. In the course of celebrating that event, bless them, the Socialist Republic, or what was left of it in Sheffield, put on a whole day celebrating the Beano and Beanos and working class holidays, taking over the library and doing, getting various people to sing.
They turned it into the seaside for the day.
And they had donkeys.
And donkeys.
And it was a most wonderful day. Sally was involved in that, weren't you? And we nearly met then.
Yeah, but we didn't really know each other then, did we?
So, what then happens?
Well, 2001, we meet, and out on a walk.
We met in Tesco's.
But we did know each other slightly. I was doing a show about rambling, wasn't I? Stuff about bird warden things as well. And you came along, we went out on a walk, and we discovered this mutual.
Yeah,
interesting.
That we knew about Edward Carpenter. And some of almost what we've said now would have been the content of our when you get together with somebody, you talk about what you've done, don't you? And you're amazed sometimes by the way your lives have intercrossed and how you might have nearly met or you could have met. And we discovered this backstory, which I think was very reassuring, just in a love story, really, to find out that we both had this interest in this strange man who lived on the edge of.
And then I buy you a weekend together at Carpenter House, which by that point is a bed and breakfast. So we go and stay there, and Joe, who's very sort of Tory and hunting, shooting, fishing, but rather a nice woman actually, and used to sort of putting up all these strange people who've come over the years because they're interested in Carpenter, says, oh, we've got a woman who keeps coming to stay here who's writing about him. And I said, is that Sheila Hobotham? Mm-hmm. She said, yes. So we remake the contact with Sheila. We do stuff together. We did a workshop at Raise Your Banners, didn't we, in Sheffield?
About the songs.
Socialist songing, about the songs. We take people on radical walks around Totley and Millthorpe to visit all these funny places.
We've had a weekend in Brighton among the community down there.
Yeah,
we stayed in a gay hotel and the bloke had never heard of Edward Carpenter from just round the corner.
We took a bunch of people from Hindu Samaj in Sheffield out to Millthorpe, who were looking at Carpenter themselves and his connections with India and Gandhi and Indian sandals and Eastern mysticism and all of those things. And we still walk on where he walked every day. I think I've got we live up here, and here's St George's Farm, the Ruskin Farm, which Carpenter was interested in and thought he might actually live there himself. And we walk along up to Woodthorpe, and sometimes back round, or sometimes we go a bit further and we go to Holmesfield and back round. Or sometimes we've gone on to Northampton. We've done this with various groups. And Roni jokes that we live on a socialist ley line because from our house you can see this lane and St George's Farm. You can see across to Holmesfield, it's not quite a line, Holmesfield Church, where George Eukin, I'm mentioning him again, is buried, and Joseph Sharp, the Chartist, and across, it's a bit of a wiggly line, and across to Millthorpe. So it's sort of our patch, that bit of North Derbyshire. We're only a few hundred yards from the border. We're still writing about him, aren't we? I'm trying to write this little booklet about St George's Farm, and everybody says it was a failure, you know, that all the communards fell out with each other and with Ruskin. But ideas don't go away, do they? And Carpenter was interested, and through him, lots of ramifications into all sorts of things, environmentalism, the national park, all sorts, working on the land, all those sorts of things. So I'm still writing about him.
And I'm still writing about him. And we discovered, I mean, it's mad, isn't it? But we discovered that we're wording that. When we already were doing, we've never sat down and said, I'll do that. But by chance, there must be occasions when Sally and I, in our own house, from the windows of which you can see St George's Farm on the Socius laydown line leading out to Millthorpe, we must both have been tampering with the same bits of history. Sally's been dealing with some Victorian stuff and all some of the names she's produced. I'm writing a novel, and you have to be a bit careful not to give it away, and otherwise I'll go home and think I'll not bother. But it does feature a moment when Bernard Shaw, in my imagination, is out at Millthorpe on August the 29th, which is Carpenter's birthday, and Bernard Shaw is out there, so is my hero, I won't tell you about him, it'll spoil it for me, and so is George Merrill, who is my George, the one I like best, and I've conjured a scene in which George Merrill, the last lover of Carpenter, and Bernard Shaw, and my hero in the novel, all meet each other by the swimming pool where they used to strip off naked in the sunshine of an August afternoon. So I'm still working one part of the house, imagining a story, making mine up, because I've cut myself loose from most of the history now, and I call it 18 blank in the book like they used to in Victorian novels, so that I don't have to get it right. But I think the situation is right. And Sally and I, as we left the house this morning, we had two questions for each other. The second one's easy, but the first one is, who do you really like? I don't think I've ever really written about Edward Carpenter since that very first thing as a student. I've written about the world he lived in, I've named a school after him, I've quoted his writings, I've written about other people in his life, but I've not followed Carpenter in a very interesting way. I've not actually written about him. That interests me.
You've done it sort of sideways.
I've done it sideways through other people. And the other question we asked as we left the house was, how would he vote? Because Sally's discovered something about the Labour leader.
He's got some sandals! They're plastic ones, though.
Carpenter wore sandals all his life after an Indian experience, and regard freeing the limbs, freeing the members of his body, was like freeing people. He also pointed out you can't go out to war and fight and kill people if you're wearing sandals. And he wore them till the end of his life. He wore them, as you rightly say, with socks, but it was a keen thing. Anyone wearing sandals? I nearly did, but I thought it's the middle of winter. Carpenter would have worn them in the winter. Connected with that, the other question, how would Carpenter vote today? Me and Sally don't agree on how he should vote today. How do you think he'd vote, Sally?
I'm not sure. I mean, he hedged his bets all the time, and I think he would have been quite close to the Greens, and he would have been quite close to the left of the Labour Party. But it's an interesting question, because he combines those different concerns. It's hard to say.
When Sally said that he never joined those organisations, I think that is wrong, actually. But I'm remembering 60 years
well,
ago.
Maybe
he joined them all. Yeah, I think he paid a subscription and paid money to them all, actually, which is rather
moronic.
He put up money
for justice, Hyman's,
so
a lot of money.
All the splits in the left that he was involved in, I think. Yeah. He managed to frame them all. He managed to be against the First World War while at the same time as being nearly in favour of it. He didn't come out as a pacifist until quite a long way into the First World War. He was on the wrong side then, you might think. So I don't know. So you think he'd vote Labour, I think he'd vote Green.
But I think the difference between...
He'd probably vote for both, actually. Yeah.
But I think the difference between us at the moment in what we're writing is I'm being incredibly pernickety and spending time in the Sheffield archives.
And I'm free, but I'm making it up.
But that's part of trying to feed my imagination, because I'm trying to sort out in my head, you know, when I walk through the middle of Sheffield thinking, what would it have been like? Because it's so hard to imagine now. And these letters open up to you a little glimpse of that. You know, I discovered that George Hukin, again, had worked as a razor grinder for a little while at Butcher Works on Arundel Street, which is now a lovely college and cafe there. The Ruskin Mill Trust run it. So it's funny, really. But I'm trying to be quite pernickety, but still within all of that, trying to think about my own connections with Carpenter. And I think because they're so strong, because I come out of that time in the late 60s, 70s, 80s, when we were concerned with all these other things, the way you live your life, that Carpenter was. That's partly why I continue to be fascinated by it. But on Carpenter's 80th birthday, the whole of the Labour cabinet wrote to him. These days, he's remembered, I think, more perhaps for his gay politics. He was a very brave man in terms of writing very early on in the 1890s, trying to theorise and talk about homosexuality when nobody else was. This was at a time as well of the Oscar Wilde trial. He lived with his gay lover, but he never... Well, the Vicar of Dronfield tried to get him, didn't he? But nobody did. Local people supported him. They loved him, actually, I think. You talk to people in Homesfield even now who have connections with him, and they're very protective of him, which is not known. Well, it is Homesfield for its radical politics. So it's quite interesting, all that. But the whole of the Labour cabinet wrote to him. So he's remembered these days because of all the gay stuff, but it's not so long ago, and I'm sure some of you, like you, have these connections with him as a socialist too. He was never given the freedom of the city, probably, don't know, maybe because he was gay, but there is an attempt now, as Roni has said, to try and get a permanent memorial to Carpenter in the city. And we've got some mugs and some postcards towards that appeal. So, or there's information about it as well, if you'd like to take that away. But I suppose we sort of come to an end now of what we're going to say, and I think you would like us to open it out as a discussion with you. And I suppose the question would be, what are your connections? How do you think he informs some of what's going on today? What are the connections with that? How does he still speak to us? Would you say that? So is that all right, or do you want to have a break or
break?
It's still hot.
Okay, so what? 5 minutes. Mm-hmm.
Have a look at
the bookstore. Don't buy the ones I want. Don't buy these because they're not
their hours. Perhaps before we leave, I mean, that's been really informative. It's also been great, great fun. And thank you so much. So go out into the cold then for 5 minutes.
And we will sing a bit later.